Tzoraim tovim, erev tov, everybody. A pleasure to see so many people, new faces, old faces, and it's so wonderful to welcome everybody. And we're thrilled to have Shuli back for another series, this time on Jerusalem's history and places. And we look forward to a wonderful series. I want to thank her and thank all of you for coming and come this class, all our classes this evening. The Parsha Shir will be given by late. Leah Silver, tomorrow morning, my regular class on the Siddur. Next week, Rabbi Lieberman starting a new series. Mark Shapiro starting a new series Monday night on Zacharia Frankel and reaction to the whole changes in traditional Judaism, et cetera. So we look forward to learning with you. And please, as I always say, invite a friend and let's learn together and expand the wonderful offerings we have. I want to thank today Rivi and Avi Katz, who are sponsoring today's shiur in memory and loving memory of Rivi's mother, Miss Adele Kinnerick, Adina Bat Chaim Yehuda Bracha, in commemoration of her 24th Yortzeit this past Monday. The Shama should have an Aliyah. We should have many occasions to celebrate good occasions, and wish all a long life and good health. Bakasha Shuli, it's all yours.
Okay, thank you, Rabbi Talman. Hi, everybody. It's nice to have you all virtually back. If you haven't muted yourself, please do so. Please put questions in the chat. I am so happy to try and answer at the end. Sources, if you don't have them, they are in the chat. Just you'll look and you'll see Rabbi Kalman just put them in. So that's just our bookkeeping for the moment. Okay, so we're going to get started. I will just, while my PowerPoint is loading here, I will just mention Rabbi Kalman was very indulgent with my crazy schedule. Thank goodness a lot of tourism has come back, so my life is a little more chaotic. So please check the schedule before you log on, because we have some weeks on, some weeks off. This is a total of six sessions, but it's not always every Thursday. So that's all the bookkeeping. Okay. So this mini series is going to be about a place that is close to, I think, the hearts of pretty much everybody here. And that's Jerusalem, Jerusalem, crossroads of the world. I put this nice old picture here of, I hope everybody can recognize where this is. This is Jaffa Gate. It's not a recent picture, but it is it's a nice old picture of Jaffa Gate. And Jaffa Gate is such a great example of this title, Crossroads of the World. I, as well as many other tour guides, often meet people at Jaffa Gate, right? You set up a time that you're going to sit and you're going to meet each other, and this is a very convenient place to meet. And often people are late, and I'm a little obsessive about being early. So I sit at Jaffa Gate for a lot of time. And it's incredible, the languages, the costumes, the religions, the ethnicities of people that pass through that gate in a normal day. It's just an unbelievable thing. So Jerusalem, what we're going to explore is Jerusalem going from really a very small village to a concept, right? Of course, it's still a real city, right? But it's also an idea. So, for example, in Judaism, we talk about heavenly Jerusalem, right? Yerushalayim shel mala, and this like kind of beautiful vision of what the city is going to be like one day in messianic times. Those of us who live here experience a lot of Yerushalayim Shalmata, right? Earthly Jerusalem, which is a lot of traffic and a lot of noise and a lot of politics. But we have this vision in our mind of Yerushalayim Shalmala. And it's not only in Judaism. We have it in other places as well, right? Christians talk about the city on the hill. They talk about creating the new Jerusalem, right? We have a famous hymn, the new Jerusalem to be created in England's green and pleasant land. The Muslims talk about the holy city, right? Al-Quds, the holiest place, and this place is a portal to heaven. So Jerusalem is not only a physical place, but it's an idea. That's one of the reasons it gets in trouble so much. So we're going to look at it as an idea, but we're also going to look at the physical history, the story of the city. How did it begin? How did it grow? Why is it important to so many people? Jerusalem, the old city, right? We're talking, except for one of the classes, we're really two, really. We're going to be talking about the old city. The old city is give or take 1 square kilometer in area. It's tiny. People who have never been to Jerusalem, come here for the first time, are astonished at how small it is because the news about it is so disproportionate, right? Jerusalem can be on the front pages of the world's newspapers. Good chance once a week, maybe once a month, right? It's completely disproportionate to its size. So that's what we're going to try and explore. Today, we're going to do an intro, sizes, dates, timelines, but also who is the city important to and why. The next three classes, we're going to talk about three quarters, right? Not the Jewish quarter, because we did some of that last year, but the Christian quarter, the Muslim quarter, and the Armenian quarter and Mount Zion. And then we're going to do a class about breaking out of the walls in the 19th century. And our final class is going to be about the Mount of Olives. So that's just to give you a basic idea of what this class is going to be like. But we'll start with this very well-known image. If you've been to Jerusalem and you've been to City Hall, you know that this image has been reproduced on the walls outside of City Hall. It's called the Bunting Cloverleaf Map. It was made in 1581 when there already was an understanding that there is a new world. You can actually see down here in the lower left corner, right? America, the Neue Welt, the new world. And there's also all these scary sea monsters in the sea, right? But the main part of the map, of course, is the three major continents, right? Europe, Asia, and Africa, with the center, of course, being Jerusalem, right? Jerusalem is the center. Now, it's true that the world is not quite as nicely proportional as this, but in reality, Jerusalem is between these continents. The land of Israel is between these continents. So it's not crazy. It's not as if you were to take, I don't know, St. Petersburg and put it in the middle, right? It's more or less in the middle, but of course, we're also talking about on a spiritual level, on a political level. And the quote above is the same idea, except in words. This is a rabbinic quote. Of course, my midrash, Derech Eretz Zuta, the world is like a human eye. The pupil, the white is like the ocean which surrounds the earth. The pupil is like the earth. The opening in the pupil is like Jerusalem. The reflection in the opening is like the temple, right? So you have this idea of the whole world with everything zooming in, right? Remember those cool books and movies about zooming in? Everything zooms into Jerusalem. Of course, in Jewish tradition, Jerusalem, and not just Jerusalem, of course, but the Temple Mount, Har HaBayit, is the place of, for lack of a better term, the Big Bang. Of course, it's not the Big Bang in Chazal, but it's the place from which the world is created. The Evan Hashtia, the foundation stone, everything comes from that point, right? That is the center. It's not just the point where we have a connection between God and man, but it's also the point from which the entire world was created. So different religions think about this idea in different ways, but it's all coming back to a similar idea. And just to give us a sense of the multitude of identities that Jerusalem has, Jerusalem has many, many names. Now, just in Jewish tradition, we have an idea that there are 70 names for Jerusalem. I did not bring you all of them. You can go online. You can find some of them I had never heard of. Some of them are very famous. But you also have names that are not from these 70 names, Klilat Yofi, right? The height of beauty, all of these kind of very complementary descriptive names, but you also have names that are historical names at different times, right? So what are the original names that we hear about, first of all, from the Torah, right? So we hear about the city called Shalem or Ir Shalem. So if you think about Sefer Breshit, we're going to have it in the next couple parshiot, not this week, but next week and the following week, right? We have a place called Shalem, right? If you remember, Abraham has to chase the There's the battle of the five kings and the four kings. Abraham wants to get back his nephew Lot from captivity, and he chases them up to Dan, and then he comes back with all of the booty and the prisoners. And on the way, he stops in to the city called Shalem, where he gives tribute to the guy who's the king, Malkitzedek, Melech Shalem, Kohen Le'el Elyon. Okay, he's a very holy figure. He's not a Jewish figure because there is no Judaism yet. There's just Abraham. Okay, but he is a holy figure, and he's the king of the city called Shalem. Okay, now Malki Tzedek Melech Shalem is contrasted, at least on a midrashic level, with he's the hero of the story, or Avram is the hero, but he's juxtaposed next to the villains of the story, who are the kings of Sodom and Amorah. Listen to their names: Bira Melech Sodom and Birsha Melech Amorah. There's Ra and there's Rasha, as opposed to Tzedek. Okay, so this idea of Tzedek in Jerusalem, of justice in Jerusalem, they go together. Play on this in Sefer Yoshua, we hear about another king of Jerusalem whose name is Adoni Tzedek. So Tzedek, justice, right, seems to be the name of the city, but it's not the only name that we have. It seems to be not the name, but the identity of the city. Whoever isn't muted, mute yourself, please. But we hear about other names as well. Okay. Abraham goes back to this place a second time. And at this point, he goes to a place called Eretz HaMoriah, the land of Moriah, right? Eretz HaMoriah, Har HaMoriah, the place where the temple is going to be built. After he has his encounter with God, he doesn't have to sacrifice his son, and he sacrifices a ram instead. He calls the place Har Adonai Yira'eh. Right? And some people think that the name of Yerushalayim comes from Yireh and Shalem, that the two come together, right? God will see, or you will be seen, right? We have the idea of Ra'aya, that you're going to come and you're going to be seen in Jerusalem. The earliest mention that we have of the city in outside texts, in not Tanakh texts, but in outside texts, is in Egyptian texts called the El Amarna letters, which have a lot of different kings of Canaan who are writing letters to the Paro in Egypt saying, help us. And here the city is called Ur Salem, or Ir Shalem, right? It's the same thing. The city that is Shalem, that is whole, that is perfect. So these are all kind of early echoes of the name of the city. By the time we get to Navi, the city has a different name. It's called Yevus, right? That's the name we have up here. That's named after the people who are there, the Jebusites, the Yevusim. They have a fortress that they call Tzion. Mitzudat Tzion. Now Tzion starts out as just a fortress. Eventually it becomes the name for all of Jerusalem. Tzion, good question what it means. Some people suggest it comes from the word Tzia. Tzia means a desert. And Jerusalem, if you've ever been in Jerusalem and you've left to go towards the east, towards Maale Adumim, you know that pretty much the minute you leave Jerusalem and it's, you know, nicely watered parks and gardens, you're in the desert. Right. So Tzion, Tzia, we're very close to that area of desert. And we have other names, right? Another biblical name, Ariel. We hear that in Yeshayahu. We hear that in Yechezkel. Ariel, the rabbis say this is like an Aryeh, right? Like a lion, because the temple looks like a lion who is crouching, right? He's Rovetz. So all of these are our Jewish names. And of course, we have more than those. But along come foreign conquerors, particularly the Romans, right? Romans, with the Bar Kokhba revolt, the Emperor Hadrian decides that he is going to erase the name of the city, and he gives it a completely different name. He calls it Elia Capitolina. Elia is from his family name, the Hadrian dynasty. They are the Elia dynasty. Capitolina, can I enable this? Sorry, someone wants a live transcription. I enabled. If you don't like the live transcription, you can close it on your screen. Elia Capitolina means the Hadrianic city of the Capitoline gods, right? The Capitoline gods. I don't know how I close this. I do want to close it on my own screen. But Kelman, how do I do that?
Like, you want to unshare? Is that what you want to do?
No, I want to know how to not see the transcript.
The live transcript. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm not a bucky on that.
All right. Slow, no rush.
There should be a little
X.
Exit
out. Exit out.
There's a little X. Click on the little X.
All right. I'm not going to bother everybody while I do this. I'm going to just not look at it. Okay. Elia Capitolina is the Roman name that's given, the Capitoline gods. Jupiter is a Capitoline god. Along come the Byzantines, the Christians, and they say, no, this is not a pagan Jupiter. We're going to change it back to Hagia Holy Jerusalem, Jerusalem, right? The Greek version of Jerusalem. Along come the Muslims, and they actually go back to a very old description of the city, and they call it Beit HaMakdis, which of course means Beit HaMikdash, right? Or Al-Quds, the holy city. So everybody who comes along has a name, has a title for the city. It shows ownership of the city. It shows connection to the city. So that's just an interesting thing to be aware of as we go through the history here. Okay. Let's go down to very specific things, right? To understand the city, you really have to understand the topography of the city. So let's take a look at some of the topography that we have here. Okay, the map that you're looking at, of course, is the map of today's old city, right? These walls are the walls of today's old city. Okay, those are not important for the topography. The topography was always there. So I am going to erase them, but I want you just to know that they are there. Okay, basically what we have are a number of mountains and a number of valleys. Jerusalem has valleys on the east side of the city, the Kidron Valley, okay, on the south and the west side, it skirts around like this, the Hinnom Valley. It does not have valleys on the north side of the city, and that's actually super important because we know that the invaders would always come from the north. Mitzafon tipatach hara'ah. The evil will come from the north, whether it was the Assyrians or the Babylonians or the Romans or even later on in history. North is the vulnerable part of the city. Okay. You have these valleys. You also have a north-south kind of a valley that goes here, right? That is a drainage. That's why we're going to see when we talk about the Muslim quarter that a lot of the water collecting in the city is happening here in the north of the city. That's less important for us today. Okay. We also have mountains. Okay. We've got this hill. Okay. This hill, what's called here the Eastern Hill. Okay. Which is the city of David. We are not talking about the city of David, even though it's the very beginnings of Jerusalem, because we did a class about it last year, but that's the very beginnings of the city. This eastern hill, pretty narrow, slow hill, but important. This is where the water is, okay, the Gihon Spring. That's why the city begins there. The city grows to include this slightly higher hill, Mount Moriah. Okay, so that's mountain number one. We've got another mountain over here in the east, the Mount of Olives, which we're going to talk about in our last class. It's not really in the city, but it's very important to the city. And we've got a third mountain over here, which is called the Western Hill. Okay. Meanwhile, I left out our third valley, this valley, the Central Valley. Okay. Sometimes called the Teropian Valley. This is the valley that if you've ever huffed and puffed your way up from the Kotel to the Jewish quarter, that's what this valley is, right? You're down in the valley and you've got to go up to the hill. Okay. So in case my squiggling here has not, I hope it has not been too terribly confusing. Okay. We've got valley, valley, and valley. We've got mountain, mountain, and mountain. Okay. Those are the basic topographies of the city. And that's what's important to know, as well as the water, the spring. And that's pretty much what we need to know. We'll be coming back to this. But if you have that in your head, if you're able to hold that topography in your head, you should be able to understand what's going on a lot better, okay? Because it's going to be important when we talk about how did the city expand, how did it grow, change over time. So try to keep that topography in your head. Okay. Oh, I figured out how to do it. I'm so proud of myself. Okay. Moving right along. Okay. Taking a look at some of our valleys. Okay. So this Kidron Valley is a very, very important valley. It is the border of the city on the east. Okay. If we had signs that said, you know, in ancient times, you are now leaving Jerusalem, say goodbye, right? In modern Israel, we have Tzeitchem L'Shalom, right? Have a safe travels out of the city. You would put it down in the Kidron Valley. That's the natural eastern border of the city. Because that's the border of the city, that's where the graves are, right? Jews do not bury within the city because dead bodies are impure. So we don't want to have those dead bodies in the city. However, we're not going to take them far away. We want them close by. So already heading back thousands of years, and we really didn't discuss this yet, but Jerusalem goes back, give or take, between 4,500 and 5,000 years. Okay, the oldest graves, we haven't really found so much yet, but we definitely have graves that go back 3,000 years that are down in the Kidron Valley, not these big monumental ones like Yad Avshalom, but in the walls of the bedrock of the Kidron Valley, we have graves that go back to First Temple times and even earlier than that. As time passes, those graves are also down here in the valley, as well as up on the Mount of Olives. So that's a very, very important idea that this is the border of the city. We have the mention that this is the border of the city in a few different places. Okay, when David is fleeing from his son Avshalom, who rebels against him, he has to leave. He goes out to the Beit HaMerchak, to the last house, and he crosses the Kidron, and he goes up the Mount of Olives, crying and weeping, and his head is bare because he's in mourning. He's running away from his son. Okay. And that's what we have over here. The whole countryside wept aloud. This is in Sefer Shmuel Bet. The whole countryside wept aloud as the troops marched by. The king crossed the Kidron Valley, and all the troops crossed by the road to the wilderness. But we have another story, a much simpler story, and it's also just a great kind of by the way mention that the Kidron is this eastern border of Jerusalem. Okay? When King David is about to die, he summons his son, King Solomon, who's going to be his follower, successor, and he says to him, listen, I have a few accounts that I need to settle. I have some people I need to reward. I have some people I need to punish. You're a very wise guy. You figure it out, right? And one of the people he wants punished is a guy named Shimi ben Gera. Shimi ben Gera is from the tribe of Benjamin. And when David is running away from Avshalom, Shimi curses him. David's men want to go and kill him. David doesn't allow them, but he says, you know, Shlomo, King Solomon, you deal with him. So what does he do? The king summoned Shimi and said to him, this is in the Book of Kings, build yourself a house in Jerusalem and stay there. Do not ever go out from there anywhere else. Right? What does the king say to him? He says, I'm only putting one little restriction on you. And you can imagine Shimi is like shaking in his boots. But all he has to do is stay in the city. He doesn't have to leave the city. That's the only thing that the king asks of him. And how does he define leaving the city? On the very day that you go and cross Nahal Kidron, Wadi Kidron, you can be sure you will die. Your blood will be on your own head. Okay, so what's leaving the city? What is the definition of it? Crossing the Kidron. Why is this so clever? Because Shimi says, oh, great. What a relief. He's not going to do anything to me. And then he forgets, as people do. And 2 years later, he leaves the city. And then Shlomo has a very good excuse to bring him forward on charges of treason and to execute him, right? And he hasn't done anything that will look bad. So that's the story of Shimi ben Gera. But the last thing I'll say about Nahal Kidron for now is we have some fascinating prophecies in Sefer Yechezkel towards the end, in Zechariah, that talk about the end of days. And what's going to happen in the end of days? In the end of days, water is going to flow from the Kidron out to, where's the natural end of the Kidron Valley? Goes all the way down to the lowest place to the east of Jerusalem, and that, of course, is the Dead Sea. Now, that still happens today. Rainwater does flow from Jerusalem down to the Dead Sea. What's the extraordinary end of days prophecy? That the prophet Ezekiel and the prophet Zechariah talk about how that water will revive the waters of the Dead Sea. That's going to be living water, right? Dead Sea is the salty water that nothing can live in, but the water is going to flow from Jerusalem down to the Dead Sea and revive the Dead Sea. And it's this beautiful idea. And it goes back to our contrast of Malki Tzedek, the king of Shalem, and the kings of Sodom and Amorah. Jerusalem, the city of justice, is going to repair these places of death and destruction and injustice. All right, so that's our Kidron. The other valley which is a very interesting valley, is the Hinnom Valley. Okay, now we also have graves in the Hinnom Valley and right above the Hinnom Valley, what's called the Ketef Hinnom, the shoulders of the Hinnom Valley. If you know a little bit in Jerusalem, you know the Bagan Center is right near the Bagan Center, just to the west of Mount Zion. You have graves that go back to Second Temple times, and you have graves that go back to First Temple times, and they're really fascinating and extraordinary, and lots of good stuff found there, including a silver amulet that has the earliest piece of Torah ever, and that's the Birkat Kohanim. It's most of the text of the priestly blessing that we have in Sefer Bamidbar. But the Hinnom Valley, which is a perfectly nice valley, somehow lent its name to hell, right? If you say the words Gei Ben Hinnom, which is the Hinnom Valley in Hebrew, say it quickly and get rid of the ben in the middle, Gei Ben Hinnom becomes Gehinnom. Gehinnom is hell. Why does this nice valley become hell, right? It's a very strange idea. And we have this great picture from Charles Foster, Bible Pictures and What They Teach Us. Just love this picture. This is meant to be a picture of what Jeremiah describes as the worship of the Molech, which happened in the Hinnom Valley. Okay, now the Molech is a very, very horrible idolatry. We don't know exactly what it was. Different in different commentaries say different things. Some people think it was child sacrifice. Some people just think it was taking a child and putting it on this very, very hot surface and taking him away. Either way, it's a horrible, horrible thing, right? And that lent its name to hell because it's just so awful, right? And that's what Yirmiyahu says, right? Jeremiah 19, for they and their fathers and the kings of Judah have forsaken me and have made this place alien to me. They have sacrificed to other gods whom they have not experienced. They have filled this place with the blood of the innocent. They have built shrines to Baal to put their children to the fire as burnt offerings to Baal, which I have never commanded or decreed in which never came to my mind. Assuredly, a time is coming, says the Lord, when this place shall no longer be called Tophet, or Valley of Ben Hinnom, but Valley of Slaughter. All right, so what does Yirmiyahu say? Yirmiyahu says, one day we're not going to call this Gei Ben Hinnom, the Valley of Ben Hinnom, but we're going to call it Gei HaHarega, the Valley of Slaughter. Now, it doesn't happen exactly like Jeremiah says it. The name sticks. It stays the Valley of Ben Hinnom, but instead of changing it to the Valley of Slaughter, the valley lends its name to hell. And in fact, later on, centuries later, the rabbis come along and the Gemara in Erevin talks about where is the entrance to hell on earth. It is in the Valley of Hinnom. We even have this great description in the Gemara in Erevin, page 19. There are two date trees in the Valley of Ben Hinnom, and smoke comes out between them, and that's the entrance to hell. I have not gone to look for it myself, but that's what it says in the Gemara in Erevin. So that's our Gei Ben Hinnom. Okay, so that we got a little bit of our valleys. What is probably the most useful thing in everything we're going to do today is this chart, which was made by somebody named Ravit Nenner Soriano. I borrowed it off the internet. It's reminiscent of a chart that I got when I was in tour guide school many, many years ago, and it's super helpful because we want to understand how does Jerusalem's size and shape change over time, because it does change very much. So what you want to be doing is starting in the top left-hand corner. Okay, this is the earliest, and we go to the right, and then we go down to the bottom, right? And what you can see here is that Jerusalem begins right over here, right? As a very, let's annotate so it'll be easier, right? Jerusalem begins over here as a very small little city. This is what we call Yevus, what eventually becomes Ir David, right? Very, very small little ridge that is placed here because why? Because this is where the water is, and the city is going to be where the water is. All the outline in every one of the pictures is the map, is the old city of today, right? Everybody understands that, right? So this is just showing you in relation to the old city of today. So as is very apparent, the oldest part of the city is not within the walls of the city of today. We'll get back to that in a minute, but this is just to understand, this is how the city begins. When David conquers the city, David expands the city, right? He grows the city towards the north. He builds something called the Milo and the Ophel from the word Laha'apil, to go up. Okay? When and towards the end of his life, he buys the land, the threshing floor of Aravna. He buys the land to make the Beit HaMikdash. Shlomo himself builds the Beit HaMikdash. So this is our city in the beginnings of First Temple times. By the end of First Temple times, okay, we're over here, number three. Okay, really, I should have numbered these. Okay, the city expands to include that western hill, okay, what we today call the Jewish Quarter, all the way out to here to the Jaffa Gate. Now, this was discovered only much later. We'll talk about this a little bit later. We only knew very recently that the city grew like this at the end of First Temple times. We'll come back to that, okay? The Babylonians come, they conquer the city, they destroy the temple, the Jews go into exile, and when they come back over here, number four, they rebuild the city, but it shrinks, right? It goes back to even smaller than what it was in the time of King David and King Solomon, and it's only, come on down here, number five, by Hasmonean times, right, by the story of Hanukkah, that we expand to the way we were in the time of King Hezekiah, Hezekiahu, okay? Later on in Second Temple period, the city grows again. And by the end here, by this one, okay, by the end of Second Temple times, right before the temple is destroyed, the Romans come and attack the city grows to its largest size that it's going to be until the 19th century, meaning it expands north past the borders of the city that are today, right? This is where Shaar Shechem is today. The city grows past that. Later on, the city shrinks again. Roman times, Byzantine times, a little bit bigger, right? But doesn't regain that huge size. What happens to this whole part on the bottom? Okay, this map only goes up to the 7th century. About 1,000 years ago, there's an earthquake. It was in the time of Muslim rulers called the Ayyubids. There's an earthquake and the walls have to be rebuilt. And the Muslim rulers say, it's a real pain to go all the way down here to the valley. Let's cut this part out of the city. And that's exactly what they do. And from that point on, the city walls are up on the top and they do not include the whole area down on the bottom. Okay, so even if you did not get every tiny piece of this map, you get a sense of the progression. Right? The growth of the city. I hope it makes sense. It's a very, very useful map to have, chart to have. So hold on to it or keep looking at it as we continue. Okay. And if that didn't confuse you, let's take a look at timeline. Okay. And this timeline is a little bit, I apologize, it's going from the bottom to the top, so I hope that doesn't confuse people. Start over here with the nice pictures, right? On the bottom, the pictures are the various people who are ruling over the city, right? First Temple times, we have the Israelites, well, the Judeans, actually. And this is my friend Tamar Yardeni. She made this nice pictorial timeline. Second Temple period, we have Greeks, but then we also have Jewish rulers. Romans conquer the city, destruction of the temple, the year 70, the Romans conquer the city. The Roman Empire becomes Christian, okay? Byzantine period. The Byzantines are succeeded by the Muslims who come and conquer the city. They are thrown out by the Crusaders, also Christians, okay? The Muslims come along and kick them out. We have guys called Ayyubids and then Mamluks. And then we have the Ottoman Turks who are here until the British Mandate and finally the State of Israel. If you like it with more, just more words as opposed to visuals, you have it over here on the side. Okay. But what's important, I think, for our purposes, because we're going to go very soon to be talking about the various religions, is to understand who comes along when. Right. So of the three monotheistic religions, we only have Jews up until the Byzantine period. Right. We have pagans in the Roman period. But Second Temple period, First Temple period is only Jews. When we talk about Christian quarter, Muslim quarter, we don't have those things in Second Temple period because we don't have Christians or Muslims. I'm sorry if this is obvious. For some people, it's not so obvious. By the Byzantine period, the Roman Empire becomes Christian, and therefore Jerusalem becomes Christian. And we have the beginnings of Christianity and churches in Jerusalem, etc. And of course, with the advent of Islam, you have the Muslims coming to Jerusalem, the building of the mosques, the Muslim quarter, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so that's, again, simple, obvious, but sometimes obvious is important to know. Okay, any of the maps that you have here, you have, first of all, they're all online, but you can also, like, screenshot them, right, if you want to do that. I am not going to send out all the PowerPoint, but you could definitely, screenshot it and keep it for yourself. Okay. One last map, and then we'll get into, some of our religions. Okay. This is how the old city looks today. Okay. Today, the old city's population is give or take about 36,000 people. This is within the city of Jerusalem, which has give or take 900,000 people, right? So 36,000 in a city of 900,000. So the old city is very, very small in terms of population. Like we said, it's very small in terms of area, but it's also very small in terms of population. These quarters that we see here, okay, are not completely homogeneous. The Armenian quarter is pretty homogeneous. Only Armenians live in the Armenian quarter, but the Christian quarter has two mosques in it. Many of the shopkeepers are Muslim. The Muslim quarter has the very important Christian institutions and churches on the Via Dolorosa. Okay. The Jewish quarter has a not used mosque, but it does have a mosque that is in it. So it's not completely homogeneous. That's one thing to understand. The other thing to understand is that, of course, there are no borders between these quarters. You go back and forth. It's one city. Everybody goes back and forth. And when the city was under Jordanian control between 48 and 67, there were no Jews in the Jewish quarter and no Jews allowed into the city at all. And these borders have changed over time, right? So if we want to talk about before 1929, the Jewish quarter essentially went pretty much up to here, meaning there were Jews that were living all the way up to here. With the riots of 1929, most of the Jews left this area and kind of condensed themselves into the Jewish quarter. It was not so friendly for them to be in this area of the southern Muslim quarter. In different time periods, Jews lived over here in the Muslim quarter. They lived here near the Temple Mount. They lived on Mount Zion. Each period is different. When the Muslims control the whole old city, they kick the Christians out of this area. When the Christians return, they come back. So there have been changes all along the way. What are the anchors of each of these quarters, right? Why are the different people in the different places? The Jewish quarter is the oldest of all the quarters within the walls, and we'll talk about that a little bit when we get to the Jews. The anchor of the Jewish quarter is the proximity to the Temple Mount and, of course, to the Western Wall. The anchor of the Christian quarter is the Holy Sepulchre. Everybody wants to be close to there. The anchor of the Armenian quarter is the St. James Cathedral. And the Muslim quarter, they want to be close to their holy places on the Temple Mount. Okay, so that's their anchors. We tend to talk about four quarters. As you can obviously see, we do not mean quarters as fractions. They are not fractions. Okay, quarters as in residences. Somebody just wrote a book now. I cannot tell you if it's any good because I haven't read it, but I've heard about it. And he calls the nine quarters of Jerusalem, meaning quarters as in residential areas. And he talks about groups that are much less known, right? The Indians and the Gypsies and the Africans, right? And so there are different peoples who live in the old city, and it's not so simple, but this is how we tend to divide it up. Okay, and with that very, very lengthy introduction, let's take a look at our three major monotheistic religions and why they feel connected to Jerusalem. So Judaism, of course, is the very first one, right? We talk about monotheistic religions. Jerusalem is around before Judaism. It's around in the prehistoric period. It's around in the Canaanite period. But King David is the one who conquers Jerusalem and makes it the eternal capital of the Jewish people. Now, that doesn't mean it's the first capital. And if you know a little bit about your Tanakh, you know that there were many cities that were important before Jerusalem, right? Where they had religious significance. significance or political significance. We have Beit El, and we have Shechem, and we have Shiloh, and we have Giv'ah, which is where King Saul is, and we have Hebron, which is where King David is in the beginning. But the ultimate, the final place, is Jerusalem. Whoever is writing, stop writing. The final place is Jerusalem, and how that happens we'll talk about in a minute. So just to get a sense of the timing that we're talking about, right, we have the Canaanite period, but then 1000 BCE, right, this is all BCE, so 1000 BCE, King David conquers Jerusalem and makes it his capital, so 3,000 years ago, give or take, right, all of these dates are not completely exact. King Solomon builds the temple, King Hezekiah expands the city, but he also digs the Hezekiah tunnel. We have the exile in two stages, 597 and then 586, and then the return, right? The second temple period where Cyrus allows the Jews to return. The temple is rebuilt and it is standing until the year 70, right? And of course, the highlights, the most significant building in this whole period is the temple, and particularly the second temple. Right? As the Gemara says, if you haven't seen Herod's temple, as in the late second temple period temple, you've never seen a beautiful building. So that's a very significant milestone, right? And this is a time period where the city is only a Jewish city. Okay, it doesn't mean there aren't others who live there. We certainly know that in the time of David, you have Hittites, right? Uriah, Hittite. Right, you have Jebusites, Aravna, the guy that David buys the threshing floor from. He's a Jebusite. So we have different peoples who are living in the city, but its nature is a Jewish city. Okay, the city begins in the city of David. Okay, and it grows to, like we said, include the Temple Mount. So there's a picture here of the stepstone structure, the Jebusite fortress of Sion, Mitzudat Sion, and that's David conquering the city. He chooses the city as his capital. It's not so obvious, right? Why is this a great choice? So you ask people that question and they say, well, he chooses it because he knows that this is the holy place, that this is the place of the binding of Isaac, that this is the place of the Evan Eshtiav, the foundation stone of the world. Of course he chose it for that. But it doesn't say that in Sefer Shmuel, right? It doesn't tell us any of those things. It's not obvious from Tanakh that Jerusalem is going to be the place, right? When we talk about in Sefer Dvarim, in the book of Deuteronomy, that one day God's going to bring you to the place, right? The Menucha and the Nachala. What is that place? It doesn't tell us in the Torah. It's not obvious. And David chooses this place. Why does he choose this place? So we have a little bit of a hint in the description in the book of Samuel. All the elders of Israel came to the king of Hebron, and King David made a pact with them in Hebron, and they anointed David king over Israel. Now listen to the next verse. David was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned 40 years. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months. In Jerusalem, he reigned over all Israel and Judah 33 years, right? So when he comes to Jerusalem, he reigns over everyone, not only over Judah. David's goal is to unite the people, and he chooses the city of Jerusalem because Jerusalem is a city that is divided between two tribes, the two tribes that are fighting with each other, Judah and Benjamin, right? Saul's tribe of Benjamin, David's tribe of Judah, and this is the city that's going to unite them. He has to conquer the city, okay? It's not in his hands. It's in the hands of the Jebusites. How does he conquer it? It seems that they're in this very impregnable position with this big fortress on the top of the hill, right? Keep going. The king and his men set out for Jerusalem against the Jebusites who inhabited the region. David was told, you will never get in here. Even the blind and the lame will turn you back, right? David will never get in here, but he manages to do it. How does he do it? Maybe through the water. Those who attack the Jebusites shall reach the water channel. Today, in the excavations in the city of David, in the city of David, we've discovered a water system that's protected by a very large, impressive tower. But all you would have to do is kind of get the guards knocked out at the tower, and then you could go through the tunnel of the water system, through the tunnel that people would walk through to get to the water, and you'd be in the middle of the city. Right? This is more for a class on Ir David, but it's just important to know. But once David has the city, he takes steps to ensure that it will remain the eternal capital. Right? And this is where we get back to that story that we had in the beginning, where, well, two stories, right? First, the Aron, the Ark of the Covenant, which had been taken by the Philistines, given back because they had many, many plagues. But then they have all these troubles, and David is one of his first acts as king. What does he do? He brings the ark to the city, right? So just take a look down at the middle here. David went and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David amid rejoicing, right? And there's all this partying, and there's dancing, and there's craziness. David in the house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouts and blasts of the horn, right? And he gets into trouble with his wife, but there's lots and lots of wild celebration, and that's the first step towards making this the capital, bringing the ark back. Right, we have this great picture of David on the instruments here celebrating. But what he does is he doesn't allow the ark to leave the city. And even when he is sent into exile because his son rebels against him, the ark stays in the city. He instructs the Kohanim to bring the ark back to the city. And by doing that, he creates this eternal capital of Jerusalem. So that even though in the short term, the unity breaks, right? The people of Israel do not stay unified. By the time of David's grandson, Rehoboam, they have broken up into a kingdom of Israel and kingdom of Judah. Jerusalem stays in their memory as the capital. And when the Jews go into exile, into this Babylonian exile, they don't forget Jerusalem, right? And this is why we have this, of course, the famous psalm, right? Al Naharot Babel, by the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept as we thought of Zion. If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither. And this is why throughout the exiles, people have had a Mizrach on their walls. They've said Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim under their wedding canopies. Shul's face towards Jerusalem. David ensured that Jerusalem remained in Jewish memory so that eventually we would come back. And that's the place in Jerusalem for the Jews. Let's move to the place, the religions that I think are less familiar to us. And that's, of course, Christianity and Islam. Christianity, of course, begins as a sect of Judaism. Okay. Jesus is a Jew. All of his followers are Jews. We're in a time period of great sectarianism. But Jesus lives and dies as a Jew. And it's only later that this group breaks away and creates their own religion. And we have the beginnings of Christianity. And we have Jerusalem becoming a Roman city, but it only becomes a Christian city when the Roman Empire becomes Christian. Okay. And that's when you have the Byzantines. The 300s, Byzantines ruled Jerusalem. Queen Helena builds the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The walls of Jerusalem are rebuilt. The Crusaders, of course, have a deep connection to the Kingdom of Jerusalem. The picture that I brought here is a copy of a piece of a famous map from Jordan called the Medva map, which has a map of Jerusalem as it was in the 6th century of the Common Era. And this is a map of, it says in Greek, the Hagia Polis Jerusalima, the holy city of Jerusalem. You can see the Cardo very nicely here, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Jerusalem becomes the important city for Christians, whether or not they live there, right? They talk about it, they sing about it, they come on pilgrimage, they put it on the floors and the walls of their churches. But what does it go back to? So let's understand some of the New Testament stories about Jerusalem. So again, Jesus, in the context of the first century of the Common Era, is a Jew living in a time that is, the Jews are riven by sectarianism. We have people who believe in the oral law of the rabbis. We have people who have their own interpretations of the oral law. We have ascetics. We have people who run away and don't like the temple and they go down to Qumran. We have divisions over how we should be vis-a-vis the Romans. We have pacifists. We have fighters. We have so many different divisions. Jesus is in that context, right? And the stories about him in the New Testament, on the one hand, have to show that he's a good Jew, right? And he comes to the temple and he's connected to the temple. And that's, we have the story in the book of Luke. And realize, of course, all the stories in the Gospels are written later, right? They're written after Jesus is no longer, and there's a lot of polemics that are put in there, right? But here we have Jesus going with his parents to Jerusalem for Passover, right? Going up for the pilgrimage festivals. The festivals of the Aliyah Regel are very important in the Gospels. The stories take place around them. When he was 12 years old, they went up to the festival according to the custom. After the festival was over, while his parents were returning home, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. They were unaware of it, right? They lose him. They don't know where he is. After 3 days, they found him in the temple court, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions, meaning, where is he? He's in the Lishkat HaGazit, talking to the rabbis of the Sanhedrin. Does this story happen? It doesn't matter if it happens. This is how the Gospels want to portray Jesus, as someone who goes to the temple, who's involved in that world, who's a prodigy, who's an Eloi, right? He knows so much Torah, everybody is so amazed. Okay. On the other hand, he's in this world, but he has a lot of criticism about this world. Now, this criticism is actually not so different from the criticism that the rabbis have, right? And we have this very famous story here in the book of Mark, right? He came into Jerusalem. Here he's already an adult. And he entered the temple and began to drive out those who were selling and those who were buying in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. And he is saying, it's my nation. My house should be called the house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it into a den of robbers. This is a theme that we have already in Yirmiyahu, right? In Bayit Rishon. Is this what you've done to my house? You have it in Chazal, who are disgusted by the greed and the corruption in the temple, who try to bring down the prices, right? So Jesus is very much in this tradition, but of course, in the Gospels, he has to be portrayed as somebody who is against the rabbis, who's against the teachers. Right? So we have this image of the corruption in the temple, which, like we said, we had before. We have him going on Aliyah HaRegel. And in fact, the final story of Jesus's life takes place around Pesach, right? It's around Pesach. He comes, we have the story in the book of Luke. We won't read the whole story, but came the day of unleavened bread, right, on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. So Jesus sent Peter and said, go and prepare the Passover meal for us that we may eat it. And he said, where do you want us to make preparations? And he tells him, there's this guy, he's going to rent out a room from him. What's this room, right? According to Christian tradition, this is a room called the Cenaculum. It's on Mount Zion. Christian pilgrims go there today. It's a very, very significant moment, because this is where he sits with his disciples. He tells them, I know one of you is going to betray me. And this is where he also has the whole idea of the body and the blood, right? What we call the Eucharist. Take a look. He took a cup, and after giving thanks, he said, take this and divide it among yourselves. I tell you now, and I will not drink of the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes. He took a loaf of bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to them, saying, this is my body. And he did the same with the cup. This cup is the new covenant in my blood. So these are very foundational moments in Christianity, and they're happening in and around Jerusalem, in and around the temple. He comes and he heals people at the pools that people come to, the mikvaot, or for drinking water. All of these stories are happening in and around the temple. And of course, the final story is happening in Jerusalem as well, right? And that's what we call the story of the Via Dolorosa, the Stations of the Cross, where he goes and he's taken and he's betrayed, and then he's put on trial, and then he has to carry the cross through the streets, right? You know, the book of John, and Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged, and the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they said, hail, King of the Jews. And he carried his cross and he went out to the place of the skull, and they crucified him, right? And this is incredibly important for Christians, particularly for Catholics. And you'll see people who will be carrying huge crosses, especially around Easter time, walking through the streets of the city. Today there's a very accepted route called the Via Dolorosa that goes from the Muslim quarter all the way to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is the end of the story. But that route has changed over time. It's not always been the same. At times it included Har HaZeitim, at times it included Har Tzion. Today we think that if there was a trial at all, it took place in the governor's palace by what we call today the Tower of David, okay, the citadel, where we found Herod's palace, and the Roman governors were there afterwards. And probably it was a much shorter walk than pilgrims do today. It went from basically the Tower of David by Jaffa's Gate to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is a very short walk, but that's not the way pilgrims walk today. Okay, finally, let's take a look at Jerusalem and Islam. Okay, Islam, of course, is the third of the monotheistic religions, and it's the last, and it takes many ideas and holy figures from Judaism and from Christianity. Muhammad sees himself as the last prophet, but preceding him are Abraham and Moses and David and Jesus. He considers all of them to be holy and all of them to be important. And there is significance to many Jewish ideas. And in fact, according to Muslim tradition, it's not written in the Quran, but very early writers write about it. The very first direction that Muslims face in prayer was Jerusalem. Okay, they eventually face to Mecca. Muhammad changes it to Mecca, but he starts out by saying, you should face Jerusalem. Now, does he do this because he wants the Jews to feel a connection to what he is creating here? Or does he want to convert them? Or it's hard to know. But Jerusalem is important already from the beginning. Okay, so let's just look at the timeline for a minute. Muhammad founds Islam in 620. In 638, as part of this incredibly quick conquest that Islam does of pretty much half of the known world in about 20 years, hey, Omar conquers Jerusalem. The Jews are allowed to return to the city. They were kicked out under the Byzantines. They're allowed to return to the city. From 638 to 1099, we have Muslim rulers in Jerusalem. And in that time, we have the building of the Dome of the Rock, the building of Al-Aqsa. Okay? In 1099, the Crusaders conquer Jerusalem, murder many, many Muslims and many, many Jews. But by 1187, okay, with Salah ad-Din, the Muslims come back to Jerusalem and stay there essentially until the British come along. So it's a very, very long time period between with the first Muslim conquest, the second Muslim conquest. The most famous connection of Islam to Jerusalem is what's called Muhammad's night journey, right? Which has two pieces. One is called the Isra, which is the journey, the night journey to the furthest place. See in the Quran, right? It says, glory to him who made his servant travel by night from the sacred place of worship to the furthest place of worship, Al-Aqsa, the Katseh, the end. It does not say Jerusalem, but very early on, it is identified with Jerusalem. Once he gets there, he is taken up to heaven. That's called the Miraj. He ascends to heaven. He meets the angel Gabriel, and he meets all the bigwigs, right? He meets Abraham. He meets Adam. He meets Moses. He meets Jesus. He meets everybody. He meets with God, right? Very, very significant moment in Muslim tradition. The picture that I'm showing you here is a picture of my little brother many years ago. He is now 40. This is when he was 13. And this is a picture of him standing at the excavations by the southern wall, which were not excavated yet. Okay. This is very high up today. The floor was dug down, but he has his hand through a hole there. This hole, according to Muslim tradition, is where when Muhammad comes on his night journey, he comes on this fabulous winged horse called Burak, as in Barak, lightning. He's very, very fast. And he ties his horse through that hole there. Okay? So this is very much part of Muslim tradition. The belief is that the Dome of the rock, which the Jews, of course, call the foundation stone, the Eben HaShtia, the Muslims see this as the place where Muhammad's footprints are. From here, he ascends to heaven. Okay? In connection to the Jews, Omar, the conqueror, allows the Jews to return. Okay? He allows them to come back. And this is a letter from the Cairo Beniza, which says that Jews from Tiberias, 70 households, come back. But Omar also says to the Jews, show me where your temple was. Okay? And they show him the temple site, covered in garbage because the Byzantines had no regard for the temple. And Omar and then his later successors, okay, a dynasty called the Umayyads, the first one named Muawiyah, builds one mosque by the area of the Temple Mount. Later on, someone named Abdul Malik, towards the end of the 7th century of the Common Era, builds the Dome of the Rock, a shrine to the center of the world. He builds it octagonal, like the Christian churches of the time. Okay? Then he builds the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is what you see in the pictures here. This is Abdul Malik. And this becomes the third holiest site in Islam. It is not the first. The first is Mecca. The second is Medina. But for Muslims, Jerusalem becomes an exceedingly important place, albeit because it was holy to Jews first, but they definitely have a very strong claim and they see it as some place that is very significant to them. Now, what's fascinating is that up until very recently, there was a complete acknowledgement by Muslims that this was the place of the temple. They call this the place Beit Maqdis, right? Beit HaMikdash. In recent years, propaganda has said, no, Jews only showed up here in the 19th century, the colonists, there was no temple. But the early approach was this place is holy, and it was holy to David, and it was holy to Solomon, and that's why it's holy to us. Okay, finally, a vision of the future. This is a picture of Birkat Kohanim, of the priestly blessing, which happens in Jerusalem at the Western Wall on every pilgrimage holiday. Masses and masses and masses of people. But the vision is not only for Jews. The vision is that everybody will come to Jerusalem, and one day we will see that while we all hold it holy, we'll be able to share it. That's really what the vision is, and that's the book of Isaiah. Right, chapter 2, in the days to come, the mount of the Lord's house shall stand firm above the mountains and tower above the hills, and all the nations shall gaze on it with joy. And the people will come and say, will go and say, come, let us go up to the mount of the Lord. Kumu v'nale har beit har Hashem, beit Elokei Yaakov, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may instruct us in his ways and walk in his paths. Ki mitzion titze Torah, right? And the Torah will come from Zion and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. So that's our hopes for the future. Let's see if we have questions, comments. Let's see. What do we got here? Yeah, so the maps. 36K people in one square kilometer sounds very dense. And indeed it is. It is indeed very dense. Hey, witness on Edger Meet on Pesach. There have been many, many books that have been written about the accuracy of the Gospels, and does it work with our sources? I am not going to go into that. For me, it was interesting to place the story in the context of Jewish sources. I don't think they're having bread on Pesach. I think they're having matzah, and they're calling it bread. Wasn't there a short period just before 638 in which Jews had rules over Jerusalem? They didn't have Jews rule over. There was a period where the Byzantines are conquered by the Persians. Okay, it's not Jewish rule, but it's not Byzantine rule. It's better for the Jews, but it's not Jewish rule. No, the Jews do not rule at all after the Bar Kokhba revolt. Persian period, thank you. Was Muhammad's trip actual or in a dream? And that you would have to ask a scholar of Islam. What's important, I think they would say it's actual, although I'm sure that there are revisionist scholars who will look at it differently. But certainly the orthodox approach is that it's an actual trip. And certainly if you talk to Muslims today, ones who are interested in Jerusalem, they will say it's actual. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, everybody. I don't know if anyone else has questions they want to ask just verbally. You can. If not, I will not see you next week. Remember, the week after, God willing, we will start to dive into our quarters. So thank you, everyone, and Shabbat Shalom. And yes. And
Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you. Shabbat Shalom. Thank you.
Shabbat Shalom. Thank you.
Thank you, Shuli. Thank
you.
Shabbat Shalom and Chodesh Tov.
Chodesh Tov.
Have a good week. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.